So a few comments before I really start. So first of all, maybe Matthias will be mad at me. Well, is he you?
Yeah.
Yes, good. I think ansatz is a bad word in mathematics. The word ansatz really means I had a great inspiration. I'm telling you what came out of it, but I'm not telling you what the inspiration was. Or, you know, maybe it's a different, maybe on the other hand it's a good word because it means that it leaves us the challenge of figuring out what the inspiration was, or where did this ansatz come from?
I agree.
Ansatzes should never stay ansatzes.
That's right. And it took 80 years for Betanas to understand what's going on.
No, but it took Beta less than that. He must have had some inspiration. Anyway, some rationale. Okay, the other comment is so it's completely unrelated to anything, but you were speaking about particle moving with various momenta and interacting on a line, and it reminded me of an old riddle. So very easy also. But lovely. So you have m particles moving along a line in this direction, and n particles moving along a line on the other direction with speed v. Now, every time two particles hit each other, you hear a bang, and they reflect totally to the other direction. And the question is, how many bangs will you hear? Real. You know, if you're bored, you can always answer this. So think about this instead of listening to my talk. Also, before I really start, here's a lovely exercise for the previous lecture. So basically, well, I never told you what the constants were in Gaussian integration, but here it is. The integral over r of e to the minus x squared over 2 is the square root of 2 pi. So use this Fubini theorem and polar coordinates in order to compute the integral of the corresponding things in Rn, on Rn, in two different ways, and then deduce the volume of the n-dimensional sphere. In fact, the n-1 dimensional sphere. So basically, those techniques of Gaussian integration and perturbation theory and a little bit of counting allow you to compute the volume of the n-1 dimensional sphere, which is sort of a nasty formula, if you will, and that's where it comes from, or that's a place where it comes from. And now, let me move on and start with my real talk for today. So, last time, in fact, if you want, the first talk that I gave was an ansatz. Here is an ansatz for an invariant. The second talk was the explanation for that ansatz. It comes from QFT via perturbation theory in some way. And I left many details out, and basically I left the second half of the handout that I gave last time untouched. And I want to leave it this way because I want to answer other questions like, who cares about this invariant? So today I will tell you why, when I wear my topologist hat, I care. Tomorrow I will tell you why, when I wear my algebraist hat, I care. And then after that we will generalize. Okay? So today I will tell you that the invariant I was talking about yesterday and before has a very clear topological origin. So first of all, what's a knot invariant? A knot invariant, in the most general sense, is just a function whose domain is knots. In fact, the word invariant is a synonym for the word function. Just like the word transformation, operator, it's overused notion, okay? But really, when we say invariant, we mean something more. We mean that the domain space, but in our case not, is some hard to understand domain space in which things have many presentations, but it's very hard to decide when two things are equal. And then an invariant should be some computable function, something that you could actually compute from a presentation, and that would not change when you switch from one presentation to another. Of course, that's the meaning of it being a function, otherwise it's not well defined. Okay? And whose target space is something where you can test equality. Is something where you can test whether two things are equal or not. And of course, the point of an invariant is that if you compute it on two different nodes, or two different node presentations, and you're not sure if those two node presentations are actually the same node or not, if you compute the invariant on these two and you get different answers, then you know they're different. Okay? So more precisely, in the case of nodes, so a typical invariant would be some function C, say, defined on the space of projections of the node to the plane, so not diagrams, pictures like this one, modulo, so well defined under the moves in which change the projection but do not change the node. And there are three such moves, and in fact one can show that there are only three such moves. So you can get from any node picture to any other via these three moves if it's the same node. Okay? So those three moves are, if you have a king, you can undo it. If you have sort of a pair of intersections that are somehow superfluous, so a pair like this, you can move it that way, and then again, as a knot, these two are the two sides are the same, but as a projection to the plane, you know, different projections to the plane. And likewise, there is the so-called Rademeister 3 move, in which you have a crossing and a strand that runs underneath it, and then you can sort of push it down to run underneath it on the other side. Okay? And you can show that you can get from any presentation of a knot to any other presentation of a knot, of the same knot, via these three moves. So an invariant would be a function on the set of presentations, which is easily computable from the presentation, and which is invariant under these moves, into some easily defined, easily understood space. For example, polynomials in the variable z with coefficients in the integers. But of course, it could be anything else. Okay? Example, the Conway polynomial is a well-known such invariant. It has values, as I said, in polynomials with integer coefficients. And one way to define it is via the following recursion formula. So the Conway polynomial satisfies the following two relations. First of all, if you evaluate the Conway polynomial on some big knot, but I'm not drawing the big knot, I'm only drawing a single crossing from that big knot. And then if you evaluate the Conway polynomial on the same big knot, except you replace the crossing, well, this is an overcrossing, you replace it by an undercrossing. Or this is a right-handed crossing, again, there is some right-hand rule that tells you that this is a right-handed crossing. If you replace it by a left-handed crossing, and you take the difference of the two Conway polynomials, what you get is z times the Conway polynomial of the thing in which you replace the crossing altogether by a bridge kind of things, okay? By two strands that run parallel to each other without crossing, okay? Now, with this recursion formula, you can almost compute the Conway polynomial of any node you wish. Why? Basically, this tells you that you can switch a crossing from an overcrossing to an undercrossing at a cost which is a node with one fewer crossings. So, if you you've already computed the Conway polynomial of all knots with 17 crossings, then this just tells you how to go from one knot with 18 crossings to another knot with 18 crossings. But this move of switching an overcrossing to an undercrossing, with this move you can convert every knot to the unknot. Right? Because if you are allowed to switch crossings, you can just untangle the whole thing. So using this move repeatedly and keeping track of the cost, you can convert your knot to an unknot. So in order to fully define the Conway polynomial, it's enough that I tell you its values on the unknot. Now I lied to you a little bit, because in fact, the move here from a crossing to a bridge might change the number of components. It might change a one component knot to a two component knot. So in fact, in order to base the induction, I just have to tell you what is the Conway polynomial of a k component unknot. Okay? And it is written here. So if k is equal to 1, the value is 1. If k is greater than 1, the value is 0. Okay? So this is the Conway polynomial. It's not at all obvious that it is a knot invariant. It takes effort to prove that it is a knot invariant. I'm not doing this effort. But I just wanted to illustrate to you what the values are, so I'm afraid this is barely readable also on your handout because I shrunk it very much. But anyway, here is a little computer program, here is a picture of Conway. I'm afraid on the screen it came out messy, on the paper it came out a little better. And here are the first, 15 knots or so. And underneath each one, the value of its Conway polynomial. So the Conway polynomial of the unknot is 1 by definition. If you wanted to compute the Conway polynomial of the trefoil knot, when you have to flip one crossing, the cost will be the Conway polynomial. Well, right, if you flip one crossing, it's already not knotted, it's already unknotted. That will give you the 1 here. But there will be a cost. The cost will be z times replace this crossing by a bridge. If you replace this crossing by a bridge, you can see that what you get is a two-component knot in which the two components are interlinked, so-called hopflink. And then in order to compute the invariant of the hopflink, you have to flip another crossing so as to get the two-component unknot. So you get a z squared, and the invariant is 1 plus z squared. And hence you go, and if you look at it, I think all of these values are different from each other. I might be wrong, maybe not. But anyway, that is the beginning of the proof that all of these knots are in fact different from each other. So one is 1 plus maybe and one is 1 minus. The screen resolution is not good enough to tell. But you know what? It's just barely visible that one is a plus and the other is a minus. Sorry. In fact, if I went a little bit further, you'd start seeing knots that have the same values. In fact, I mean, the Conway polynomial is far from separating knots. I'm not even sure if it separates the first 15. I didn't actually confirm it. But it definitely doesn't separate the first 100. Okay? So in fact, you need more invariants.
But you get any polynomial in Z, the unique coefficient one.
Yes.
Coming from enough?
I don't think so, no. But that's sort of, that's a different question, right? Anyway, so here's your second exercise. So pick your favorite bank, and I just realized that I found another bank, and I'm aware of another bank with a knot logo, and compute the Conway polynomial of its logo, just to see that you've understood the definition. Anyway, well, there is a whole zoo of knot invariants. There is the Conway polynomial, the Jones polynomial, various other polynomials, and various other invariants that are not polynomials. And what I want to tell you about right now is about not polynomials in a different sense. So you see, the Conway polynomial is, for every knot, you assign a polynomial. I want to talk about numerical invariants, so invariants whose values are numbers, but which can be thought of as being polynomials on the space of knots. Okay? So it's a different notion of polynomiality. Now, in fact, the numbers can be any valued in any abelian group. They don't have to be just honest numbers. So given an invariant V with values in some abelian group A, I can extend it to knots with double points. So a knot with a double point is a knot in which at some point you allow two of the strands to really intersect. You know, bang, like over there. Okay? And what you do is you just define V on a double point to be V on a V on an overcrossing minus V on an undercrossing. So a double point simply represents the difference between over and under. Okay? So you should think differentiation. Right? The derivative of a function is the difference between its values in two nearby points. Well, and some limits and so on, but fundamentally it's the difference of the values between of the function between two neighboring points. So likewise here, you should be thinking of V evaluated on an off with a double point as a derivative of the original V, because it's V evaluated on two neighboring knots, okay? Which differ only by the way one crossing looks, okay? Now, the moment you have differentiation, you want to iterate it. You want to look at multiple derivatives, higher derivatives. So suppose you had a knot with four double points. Just resolve each double point according to this rule. So for example, if I had the Miller Institute knot, the knot drawn here, it's just in the logo of the Miller Institute, which is not a bank. But anyway, if you have the Miller Institute knot and you put a double point here and a double point here and a double point here and a double point here, then you resolve each one to be the difference of an over minus an under. So this becomes over minus under, this becomes over minus under, and so on. And this means that the whole knot can be resolved in 16 different ways. Right? Because each double point can be resolved in either one of two ways. Each of the ways comes with a sign. The sign is basically minus one to the number of double points that got resolved to be left-handed. Okay? And then you evaluate your original V on those 16 knots with the corresponding, take the sum with the corresponding signs, and that's V evaluated on a knot with four double points, and you should be thinking of it like the fourth derivative of the original V. Okay. Definition. We say that an invariant is of type M, and you should be thinking of it as being a polynomial of degree M, if its M plus first derivative vanishes. Namely, if whenever you evaluate it on a knot with more than M double points, you get zero. So for example, if I had a type 3 invariant and I evaluated it on this version of the Miller Institute knot, it should be zero. Because it has because a type 3 invariant is like a polynomial of degree 3, and this is four differentiations.
And type M invariants always be expressed as polynomials.
Can they be expressed in polynomials? What do you mean? They are polynomials. This is the definition of a polynomial. A type M, to be type M, I mean, to be a polynomial on the space of knots, to be a polynomial function on the space of knots, right? The space of knots is not a vector space. A priori, there is no meaning to being a polynomial on the space of knots. So this is my definition of what it means to be a polynomial on the space of knots. Okay? Now, conjecture. Well, you see, much like there is a, you know, like much like you can approximate any function by a polynomial, it might be this true that you can approximate every function on the space of knots by a polynomial. And if that were to be true, then finite type invariants would separate knots. So conjecture, well, you know, a priori I gave you a definition of a class of invariants. So far we don't even know that it's not empty. Okay? But even before deciding if it's empty or not, let me make the conjecture that it's not only non-empty, but in fact extremely strong. Anyway, the next theorem shows that it's a non-empty class of invariants. So the Conway polynomial itself, right, takes values in an abelian group, the abelian group of all polynomials. As such, it is not a finite type invariant. However, if you look at each coefficient of the Conway polynomial, then each coefficient is a finite type invariant. So, if you write the Conway polynomial of an odd k as a power series, well, it's a finite power series, right? Depending on, I mean, it will always be a polynomial, so it will always terminate. But if you write it as Vm of k times z to the m, then those coefficients, Vm, are in themselves not invariants. They're just the, you know, V3 would be the third coefficient of the Conway polynomial. If the Conway polynomial is well defined, then its third coefficient is also well defined. So each Vm is a well-defined numerical non-invariant, and my assertion is that Vm is of type m, so in itself is like a polynomial of degree m on the space of knots. Therefore, well, maybe the Conway polynomial in itself is not a finite type invariant, but using finite type invariants of higher and higher degree, of higher and higher type, you can recover all the information in the Conway polynomial. Because if you know all the coefficients of the Conway polynomial, you know the Conway polynomial. Anyway, the proof of the theorem is a one line, a single line. The Conway polynomial evaluated on a double point is by definition the Conway polynomial of an overcrossing minus an undercrossing, which by the recursion relation defining the Conway polynomial is z times the Conway polynomial of a bridge. Now, if you had m double points, you'd be using it m times, or if you had m plus 1 double points, you'd be using it m plus 1 times, and you'd be getting that, you'd be getting z to the m plus 1 times replace all double points by bridges. But if you've multiplied by z to the m plus 1, then the coefficient of z to the m is necessarily 0. So the coefficient of z to the m within the Conway polynomial evaluated on a knot with m plus 1 double points is 0, which is what I wanted to show, which means that that coefficient vanishes on when differentiated sufficiently many times. Yes, but ask it loudly because people in the back will not hear.
So the conjecture is about finite type.
Yes.
Then on the other hand, you talk about the Conway polynomial which is separated in us, but the numerical invariants in it are.
Yes. Well, there are many, many more finite type invariants. The Conway, the coefficients of the Conway polynomial are the simplest finite type invariants there are.
When you say in the conjecture finite type invariants separate knots, you mean non-numerical ones?
No, 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 numerical ones. All of them. But all of them. Including z those that come in a similar way from the Jones polynomial, including those that come from, I don't know, the other places. No, but there are, well, there isn't a unique finite type invariant of degree n. Okay? You know, if you are in Rn, all of them do that.
Okay.
Not that any individual finite type invariant separate knots.
Okay.
All of them taken together.
Okay.
Again, if you think about polynomials in Rn, the polynomial x squared minus y squared separates, definitely doesn't separate the points of Rn. But you know, if you look at all polynomials on Rn, you can approximate whatever you want with them. Okay? So I mean, these are specific polynomials, and I want to look at the set of all of them. In fact, that's what I want to do next. I want to study the set of all non-polynomial, of all finite type invariants.
So is it easy to give some examples of something which is not a finite type invariant?
The Conway polynomial itself?
No, no.
As a whole? Yeah, the degree of the Conway polynomial. Right, the degree of the Conway polynomial is not a finite type invariant.
Yeah,
but every coefficient is.
Something
more relevant, the hyperbolic volume of the complement of the knot. But you see, it's not surprising. You know, e to the x is not a polynomial on Rn. So you would expect that if you take a random function on the set of knots, it will not be a polynomial, but it will be potentially approximatable by polynomials. Okay? Anyway, the next thing I want to do is I want to study the set of all finite type invariants, or all invariants of type n. And the idea is just like, you know, you could study all polynomials by, you know, if you want to study polynomials of degree m, you take their mth derivatives and you get constants. So it's enough to study these constants. Okay? So the claim is that the mth derivative of a type n invariant is in some sense a constant. Now, what does it mean, the mth derivative of a type n invariant? It means that invariant evaluated on a knot with precisely m double point. And the sense in which this is a constant is that if you have a knot with m double point in an additional overcrossing, and you flip that overcrossing to an undercrossing, then v does not change. Because the difference between this and that would be v evaluated on m plus on a knot with m plus one double points, which is by definition zero. By the choice of v, it's equal to zero. So therefore, you can think of v restricted to m singular knots, to knots with m double points, as being some sort of a constant. And let me explain what this constant is. So you see, if you can flip every overcrossing to an undercrossing, then nothing remains of the topology. Okay, then it's no longer embedded in R3. If you can flip things, there's just nothing left of the topology. However, what is left, what does remain, is the following. So suppose you were an ant walking along the knot. Okay, so in fact, let's go back and have a picture of a knot on the screen. So suppose I was an ant walking along the knot. The senses of the crossing no longer make sense. But I can still note in which order did I go through the double points. So the order by which I go through the double points, suppose I start here, will be 1, 2, 4, 3, 1, 2, 3, 4, and I'm back to the beginning. Maybe I messed up, I'm not sure, but roughly what I said. Now, flipping and crossing, going between over and under, is not going to change that. Okay? Now, if I want to encapsulate this ordering in a simple way, what I could do is I could take the parameter space of the knot, well, it's a circle, and on this parameter space there are pairs of points that correspond to the same double point. So like the pairs of points, these two, at the ends of the chord labeled 1, would correspond to the times that I passed through point number 1. Okay? And then, likewise, I would mark the pair of points that correspond to double point number 2, 3, and 4. And then this so-called chord diagram represents the combinatorial order by which I pass through the double points. So if I start here, I'll go through 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 4, 3. And that's exactly the same as what I had before if I didn't make any mistake. Okay? So, really, the mth derivative being a constant does not depend on the sense of the crossings, so you can think of it as a function on chord diagrams with M chords. So some so-called M chord diagrams. Okay? And with values in the same abelian group that we started from. Okay? And let's call this function W sub V, and it's the so-called weight system of the invariant V. Now, the weight system of an invariant V contains all the information about the mth derivative of that invariant. So, if I fully understand weight systems, I will have fully understood invariants of type M by induction. Why? Because if I have two invariants of type M that have the same M derivative, so the same W, then their difference will have zero M derivative. Therefore, it will be an invariant of type M minus 1. And these I assume by inductions that I've already studied yesterday. Okay, so if I want to understand all invariants of type M today, it's enough that I understand all weight systems. Okay, now a weight system is a linear functional on the space of chord diagrams. What I want to know next is whether all linear functionals are weight systems. And the answer is no. So, in fact, claim W sub V satisfies the so-called four-term relation, which says the following. So I have to explain this picture a little bit. So here is a schematic picture of the chord diagram in which I've marked only two of the chords. But W is supposed to be defined on chord diagrams with M chords. So really what I mean is that there are M minus two further chords on this picture that I didn't bother marking. And in fact, they go between the dotted parts of this sort of picture to each other. So the dotted parts are not marked. Okay? However, the parts that are marked solidly are as intended, are drawn as intended. So there are no further chords going between the solid lines here. All M minus 2 further chords go between dotted parts and dotted parts. Now, given this chord diagram, you can sort of change the order of the last two endpoints, you'll get this. Basically, there are four chord diagrams, or here are four chord diagrams that I can write on the same kind of three-piece skeleton. And the claim is that if you evaluate V on the first one, minus evaluate it on the second one, minus evaluate it on the third one, plus evaluate it on the fourth one, you get zero, always. So again, W is not an arbitrary function on chord diagrams, but it has to satisfy this relation, which later will scream out, I'm in the algebra, but at the moment it doesn't do it yet. Okay? Let's prove this relation. The proof is actually very, very easy. Consider a knot V that has one double point, a lasso that runs around it, and then lots of mess outside the picture, which is, again, never mind, but let me just say that this mess includes m minus two further double points. So this knot altogether has m minus one double points. Consider also the knot in which is the same in every way, except the lasso goes above instead of under. Okay? Now, in fact, topologically, these two knots are the same, because you could just pull the lasso out and then push it back in under. So therefore, since V was an invariant, V of this is equal to V of that. On the other hand, well, I could get from this lasso picture to this lasso picture by first flipping this crossing, then flipping this crossing, then flipping this crossing, then flipping this crossing. So a sum of four flips is equal to zero. But every time you flip a crossing, the cost is a double point. The difference between an overcrossing and an undercrossing is a double point. And we already have m minus one double point, so now we will have m, exactly m double points. V evaluated on m double points is W evaluated on some n-chord diagrams, on some m-chord diagram. So we learn that the sum of the values on W on four m-chord diagrams is equal to zero. And if you write carefully what these four are and you're careful about the signs, you find that it's this. End of proof. Are you still with me?
Do you claim that it's the only condition?
I don't claim it yet, but I will in a minute. Okay. In fact, there is an additional condition called the frame independence relation, which I prefer to ignore because it's sort of minor and easily taken care of. I mean, really, knots should always be knotted ribbons rather than knotted lines. So, you know, you should be knotting kind of ribbons like my belt instead of lines, and then this issue does not arise. But the best is to ignore it at this level. Anyway, exercise. So determine the weight system of the mth coefficient of the Conway polynomial. Right? We define the Conway polynomial, therefore the mth coefficient has an mth derivative, which should be a function on chord diagrams. What is it? I claim that I can compute it in linear time. I mean, it's a very, very easy computation. So what is it? And then verify that it satisfies the four-term relation. And a much harder exercise is to learn some more about the Jones polynomial, do the same to it, so expand it, write the coefficients, and find that they are finite-type invariants, and find what their weight systems are. So this is a bit harder, this should be easy. Okay, anyway, now comes the fundamental theorem of finite-type invariants, which is the answer to Maxime's question. The 4T relation is the only relation. I think the first proof is due to Maxim Koncievich. So every weight system, in other words, every linear function of W on the quotient space of chord diagrams, so now let's allow ourselves to take chord diagrams with rational coefficients. So it's a theorem over the rationals, I forgot to write this. So replace chord diagrams by linear combination of chord diagrams with rational coefficients, mod out by the 4T relation. So this would be the space A. A linear functional of degree M on the space A would just be a functional on chord diagrams that satisfies the 4T relation. And the claim is that any such W is the nth derivative of a type M invariant. So for every W, there exists a V such that W is W of V. Okay? So the theorem in particular means that you can enumerate finite type invariants combinatorially. So in principle, if you look at degree 17, it's a finite task to write all core diagrams with 17 chords, and then it's a finite task to write all 40 relations, and then it's a linear algebra issue to figure out the quotient space. So this was done by computer, and here are the answers. So I think that the row that we care about is the one in the middle. So, you know, there is one invariant of degree zero, and this is the constant. The constant is a polynomial of degree zero. There is one invariant of degree one, and this is sort of the self-linking. So it's the number of times, you know, if you have a ribbon, it's the number of times the two sides twist around each other. There are two invariants of degree two. One is the square of the twisting. You see, the product of polynomials is again a polynomial, and this remains true in finite type invariants. So if you had a polynomial of degree one and you square it, you'll get a polynomial of degree two. So that's one of the two. And the other is the second coefficient of the Conway polynomial. And so the story goes up to in degree 12, there are 548 invariants, and we don't know how many there are in degree 13. Okay? As I mentioned, if you multiply two finite-type invariants, again the result is a finite-type invariant. But at each degree, you get the finite-type invariant that you had from before, from the lower degrees, multiplied with each other, but also some new ones. The new ones are called primitives, and the lowest row is the number of primitives. So in degree, well, for some reason the constant is not even counted. But in degree one, there is one new invariant, this is just the self-union number. In degree two, there is one new invariant, this is the first coefficient of the Conway polynomial. Sorry, the second coefficient of the Conway polynomial. In degree three, there is one new invariant, and this is the third coefficient of the Jones polynomial. And so on, until in degree 12, there are 55 new invariants, and in degree 13, we don't know. Okay. Of knots. I mean, if you take two numerical valued knot invariants, you multiply them, it's again a numerical value.
You can't specify the value of what knot.
An invariant is a function on the space of knots. It's not associated with a specific knot. It's a function.
How do you build it? What I mean is how you build it from the two sets of knots.
There are no two sets of knots. There is only one set of knots. Okay, so suppose I wanted to tell you what V1, suppose V1 was a knot invariant and V2 was another knot invariant, and I wanted to tell you what the product is. It's the pointwise product. I wanted to tell you what the product is, what the product is on the trefoil. This is by definition V1 of the trefoil times V2 of the trefoil. Okay? So, you know, if V1 was the Jones polynomial and V2 was the Conway polynomial, the product would be the product of the Jones polynomial and the Conway polynomial. Who cares? I mean, it's not an interesting thing. But you can write it. And then the assertion is that if V1, so like ordinary polynomials, if you multiply ordinary polynomials pointwise, the result is again a polynomial whose degree is the sum of the degrees. So the assertion is that if this is of degree 5 and this is of degree 7, then their product would be of degree 12, if I haven't forgotten addition. By the way, 5 plus 7 always confuses me. I like half the time. Anyway, so how is this related to what we did before? So, the first point of contact is, in fact, the space today, A of today, is isomorphic to A of Monday or Tuesday. So A of today is the space of chord diagrams, so circles with chords inside them, modulo the 4T relation. A of Monday was trivalent graphs with a distinguished circle, but they're also allowed to be trivalent vertices, and a different set of relations. One of the relations in Monday, on Monday, was the so-called STU relation, which if you look back at the handouts, you'll see that it said that if you have, that if you have a trivalent graph sitting on top of the skeleton, the circle around, then you can replace it by this minus that. Now, take this relation and, okay, then again, what is the relationship between these two spaces? First of all, it's obvious that there is a map from A today to A Monday. And the map is, well, every chord diagram is in particular a trivalent graph. It's a trivalent graph, all of whose vertices are external, and none is internal like this. Okay? So I have to show that this map is well defined. So I have to show that the 4T relation is a consequence of the Monday relations. Okay? Now, take the STU relation of Monday, and take the Y diagram written here, and there are three ways in which you can apply the STU relation to this diagram. One way is by like thinking of this as a Y on top of a skeleton in this direction. Another way is in this direction. And the third way I don't care about. I mean, okay? So if you do it one way, you'll get this difference of chord diagrams. If you do it in that direction, you'll get that difference of chord diagrams. So two STU relations give you the four-term relation. Now, that, okay, so therefore this map is well defined. This also tells you how to define the inverse map. So if you have in A Monday a diagram that has a trivalent vertex, you can get rid of it by using STU relations. So you can get rid of all trivalent all internal trivalent vertices repeatedly by using the STU relation repeatedly, and you'll get a linear combination of chord diagrams. So that's the proof in a nutshell, ignoring many of the details. Okay? But all key points are here. So this is the first relationship between today and Monday. For the second relation, I need the notion of an expansion for knots. Okay? Or a so-called, in the world of knots, a synonym for the word expansion is a universal finite type invariant. Okay? So my claim is that the fundamental theorem, every weight system integrates, every weight system comes from an invariant, is true if and only if there exists a so-called expansion or a so-called universal finite type invariant. So that would be a thing called Z, which would be a map from knots, calligraphic K is the set of all knots, into A completed. So what's A? Well, A was chord diagrams of various degrees, modulo, right, degree is just the number of chords, modulo the 4T relation. When I say completed, I mean that instead of taking finite sum of chord diagrams, I allow you to take infinite sums, provided their degrees are increasing. Okay? So an expansion is a Z from K into A completed, such that if a specific knot K has M double points, then, well, you see, if a knot has M double points, then, first of all, Z is defined on it. Because I told you how to basically replace all the double points by over minus under. Okay? And second, there is a chord diagram underlying this knot, right? Before I had a mechanism that told you whenever you have a knot with double points, how to get a chord diagram. So let dk be the chord diagram underlying k, and the condition that I put is that z of k should be d of k, that's a diagram of degree m, plus possibly diagrams of higher degree, which I don't care about. Okay? So if you find one single z with values in a bizarre space satisfying a simple-minded condition, then you've proven the fundamental theorem.
What's dk?
Dk is the chord diagram underlying k, the norm k. Proof, and again it's a proof in a nutshell. Suppose you had such a z, and I wanted to show that every w comes from an invariant. So given a w, I need to construct an invariant. Well, what's w? What's a weight system? A weight system is a linear function on A. Oops, sorry, I forgot to put a hat on top. No, no, I don't. Sorry. But at least it shows you were watching. So, suppose I had a W going from A to the numbers. And in fact, it's not any W, it's a homogeneous W. It's defined only on the part of degree M of A. But still, well, if you want, extend it by zero to all other degrees. Okay? So W goes from A to Q, and I have a Z going from K to A. I want to construct a V. Well, it would be an insult if I told you to go this way. So I'll tell you to go this way, and I hope you're not mad. And then the claim is that the V that I just constructed, its nth derivative is W. And the proof is a minor use of this condition that I wrote. Okay? And maybe I'll leave it as an exercise. Now that's one direction. That tells you that if you have a z, you get the fundamental theorem. From every w, you can get a v. Suppose from every w, you can get a v, how would you construct z? Well, it's again, with few more words added, essentially the different w's are the coordinates of the space A. Right, if you look at W's which form a basis to the dual of A, then those W's would be coordinates on A. Now, for each one of the coordinates, you know how to find the corresponding V. So if you know all the coordinates, that would define the coordinates of Z, and if you know all the coordinates of Z, you know Z. So, and again, then it would be a minor check to find that Z satisfies the condition that we wanted. So, end of proof. And then the most crucial point, why is there such a Z? Well, obviously, we constructed it on Monday. Okay? So, the topological meaning of Monday's ansatz is that it constructs a universal finite-type invariance, meaning a single invariant that contains in it all the finite-type invariants. Okay? So it completely solves the issue of finding polynomials on the space of knots. Now, since I still have like 5 minutes,
six.
Okay, yeah, well, I know, I have a timer up there. maybe I'll tell you very, very briefly why Z has the set property. So, here is the set property. Z of K is D of K plus higher degrees. That's a challenge because I forgot to bring my props. I forgot to bring my my notes, so I have to do it by drawing pictures. Okay, so let's compute Z. On a knot with double points, and since I completely have no talent, all my knots are always the same. It's always the trefoil knot. Okay, but let's introduce some double points. So let's put a double point here and a double point here. And let's compute Z-Monday, so Z-Mon, on this thing. And hopefully I will be able to show you that this is equal to the core diagram underlying this knot. Well, what's the core diagram underlying this knot? Well, let's label the double points 1 and 2. In which order do we go through them? So let's see. 1, 2, 1, 2. So the core diagram corresponding to it will be a circle with points marked in the order 1, 2, 1, 2. Namely, there will be a chord between the ones and a chord between the twos. So it's this chord diagram. So my hope is to show that you will get that evaluated Zm on this, you will get that, plus higher degrees. Okay? Now, I don't have my chopsticks either, but I think I have three pens. So, in fact, they are colored. So, okay. So, what's the Stonehenge invariant? Sorry, I forgot the Colombian name. Infiernito. Whatever. What is the cosmic coincidence invariant of this? What? Hell. Okay. The heavy invariant of this, you try to count cosmic coincidences. But you see, if a cosmic coincidence, say, like this, so one end here, one end here, one end here, all pens are pointing at stars, was counted, then if you flip this this crossing, nothing will change. It will still be in the count. Right? Because the cosmic coincidence doesn't even see what happens in an epsilon neighborhood of this double point. So sort of the bulk of the invariant, the bulk of the computation goes away, right? It goes to zero right away once you flip a crossing. However, if one of the feet of the the cosmic coincidence was near this double point, then it would notice when an overcrossing switched to an undercrossing. Okay? So, but you see, so now you're forced to have a foot here. But then you also, but you see, we also alternate over the signs of double point number two. So we also have a foot here. Okay? And we also must have a foot here. And in fact, it's not enough that I'll have a foot on the lower strand. Because, I don't have to have a foot here because I'm not alternating this one. Sorry, I just have to have a foot here and a foot here. But you see, it's not enough that I would have a foot on the lower strand because I could alternate by moving only the upper... Sorry, it's not enough that I'd have a foot on this strand because I could alternate by just moving that strand. So I must have a foot on this strand and a foot on this strand. And a foot on this strand and a foot on this strand in these areas. Now, the smallest diagram you could possibly write, the smallest chopstick configuration that you could possibly write that has feet in all these places is the chopstick configuration in which you have a small chopstick going this way and a small chopstick going this way. And when this configuration is translated into combinatorics, it's this combinatorics. And that's the end of the proof. Or, this can be lifted to become a complete proof. But that's the whole point of the proof. And I'm done.
Do these things depict the orientation of the
unknown. Open, this is sort of the smallest open problem. It detects the orientation of ambient space. So there are two notions of orientations, and there is the orientation of ambient space, and like, you know, if you take the trefoil knot and look at its mirror image, so you flip all the crossings, then that's changing the orientation of ambient space, and these invariants detect that. But there is a second notion of changing orientation, and this is, you see, the trefoil is really oriented, there is a direction of flow here. And if you flip the direction of flow, in the case of the trefoil, the result is the same knot. But there are knots for which switching the direction of the flow gives you an inequivalent knot. And it's not known if finite type invariants detect that.
The core diagram is the same, or
not? No. I mean, if you... no, the core diagram gets orientation flipped. I mean, so for example, I mean, this core diagram, if you reverse the order in which you traverse the knot, is the same. But you know, I could break the symmetry. Okay, this core diagram, if I go this way, I see the head and then the tail. And if I go the other way, I see the tail and then the head of this sort of caterpillar. So it's not known whether weight systems, meaning linear functionals satisfying 4T, detect the difference between this core diagram and the one that you get by flipping over the caterpillar.
Yes, but not the same.
You should be asking the chair, not me. I mean, I'm happy to get questions from anyone.
You know that we can complement the knot in R3.
Yes.
The 500 of that complement completely classifies the knots.
Yes.
How are you, there is a good problem with that, from what I know.
Yeah.
Is this good towards solving that problem?
No. I mean, there doesn't seem to be a... No. The short answer is no.
My name is undercutting the sums of knots, but this.
So in some sense, this is the algebraic part of my, this is the algebraic, or a tiny part of the algebraic motivation. Yes, it multiplies. But, well, that would fit in tomorrow's lecture better.
Okay, other questions?
Thank you.